What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got very special guest, Mitchell Hoddle. Mitchell works for Blockware, and he's just overall a great analyst, talks a little bit about mining, their overall state of Bitcoin, you know, how everything's looking in the overall macro environment, some of the things that he's excited about, bullish, a little things that worry him, and much, much more. So tune in for another action-packed episode. As always, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And lastly, big shout out to my sponsor, PlebLab, down in Austin, Texas, the number one hacker space in all of Bitcoin, in all of the world, and everywhere. I mean, like, PlebLab's just absolutely killing it. If you check out their Twitter, PlebLab, one word, they're absolutely crushing it, giving you the best courses to become a developer if you want, putting a bunch of great developers all under one roof, and allowing companies to showcase their abilities with Startup Day and other things like that. So support the boys down in PlebLab. Buy yourself a ticket for something. Buy yourself a course to learn how to code a little bit. And yeah, now let's get into the episode. Whoosh. Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, Mitchell Hoddle, who tells me he's jacked up right before the pre-show. So I think we're ready to get ripping and rolling here. We did have a big dupe in this morning of the Cointelegraph. So those who are not on Bitcoin Twitter, Cointelegraph tweeted out that the BlackRock spot Bitcoin ETF was approved. Turns out it wasn't, and it was all like still under review. We got a big shoot up and then a big shoot back right back down to reality. So we'll start it there. Mitchell, how you doing? And yeah, man, like what do you take of all this scenario of Cointelegraph, the big up, the big down, riding the waves, Bitcoin Twitter to start the week here on this Monday morning?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brandon. I normally don't get emotional about price action, but for some reason, this just like, it got to me, man. I believed the news at first. And I think it's so insanely bullish because the rumor only circulated for like 15 minutes before it was shut down. But Bitcoin went from like 27 to 30 like that. And this isn't even, the ETF didn't get approved, obviously. So this is just all people sort of front running that. Imagine how it's going to be when this thing actually gets approved and when institutional capital actually starts flowing into Bitcoin. Even 1% allocation from these massive institutions is going to send Bitcoin well into the six figures. So it was quite a roller coaster of emotions this morning, especially like for a Monday morning. It's just not what I expected. I was sitting in a Starbucks, like starting to work on my stuff and whatever. And I just like start laughing my butt off. People are looking at me like I'm freaking crazy, but I'm checking the charts. Bitcoin's up 8% in like 5 minutes. All the mining stocks are pumping. And then, you know, 15 minutes later, it all comes crashing back to reality. It's quite the roller coaster of emotions in about a 15, 20 minute span.
Yeah. So we're recording this on Monday, October 16th. So for those who are kind of, I guess, listening at a later time, because this episode will be dropped a little bit later, you know, you get our kind of live reactions to everything, right? I mean, it is interesting, you know, that we did see the pump, and I agree with you 100% that it's like, hey, this is only the tip of the iceberg. We saw it where the news dropped on Twitter, 8% increase, and then big fall back down. Do you, I don't know, man, getting out the tinfoil hat here, do you think that this was like maybe planned, or was it, you know, maybe somebody just got some misinformation and kind of ran with it? Why do you think this kind of happened? Are you maybe on the conspiratorial side of things and think somebody profited a little bit off this pump or what?
Someone definitely did, although I think the most likely culprit here, and I kind of fell victim to this myself, is when a breaking news event happens, everybody wants to be on it first, right? And people don't really wait for facts. You had a few people like kind of cautiously optimistic, but like I think I tweeted like the eyes emoji and like a rocket ship or something, you know, nobody ever really waits around, right? You want to, I think it's maybe it's part of like the Twitter engagement, just like hype. Everybody wants to get maximum amount of engagement. And apparently the Cointelegraph social media intern is no different. They didn't really wait for confirmation. They probably saw one tweet that said it's approved and they just launched. And I don't even know that they were the first one to necessarily like break the story, but they were the most credible, right? I was pessimistic at first. And then I saw Cointelegraph had tweeted. I'm like, all right, this must actually be legit. So I think it's really more of a rush to break a story without any confirmation first is what's going on. Not necessarily someone with like malicious intent took out a leverage long position and then went on Cointelegraph and tweeted this.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I definitely fell victim to it. I saw it on Cointelegraph. I saw there's some big other accounts tweeted and I was like, all right, well, I guess like my sources are everybody else and hopefully they have credible sources. So, I mean, hand up here, I fucked up a little bit. So, I mean, everybody, I think kind of, you're right, falls victim to that. But it seems like there's a lot of like hopium around this, right? I mean, we're in this bear market. And it seems like everybody's just kind of waiting for this Bitcoin, like the spot ETF to be approved. So like, let's take it a step back here. Like, what's your overall view just on that in general, like the spot ETF? And yeah, because, you know, I feel like we have kind of two separate Bitcoiners here. Like one that it's like, you know, Bitcoin doesn't need this spot ETF, right? Because, you know, the true, you know, decentralized nature of Bitcoin, being able to be your own bank, that kind of thing. But then you have the people on the other side of things. Well, it's like, hey, well, you know, institutional money now gets access to Bitcoin. That's going to pump everybody's bags. So where do you kind of lie on that? And yeah, man, take it away.
And maybe it's cheating to say I lie in both camps because I fully agree. And I will always tell everyone to self-custody, buy Bitcoin, hold your own keys, because fundamentally, that's the only way to actually own Bitcoin. That's the only way to actually verify that you own a cut of the 21 million and nobody can take it from you. When you have it in an ETF, it's not the same thing at all. You know, if the government went corrupt or the custodian went under, you're not going to have that Bitcoin. It can be taken from you. But at the same point, institutions are not the same as retail. They cannot just, you know, have a single SIG set up and hold their own keys. And you've got a lot of people out there who are sort of scared of responsibility, I would say. They want to just buy Bitcoin and have someone else manage it and not have to worry about it. They don't want to have to get set up on an exchange and set up a hardware wallet. They just want to go into their pre-existing setup with Fidelity or BlackRock or Charles Schwab or whoever and click one button and have Bitcoin in their account, in their portfolio alongside all of their other assets. That's where you're going to get all of the institutional capital to flow in, quite frankly. And it's not a bad thing because I think the number one marketing tool for Bitcoin is number go up at the end of the day. We're obviously in it for different reasons, but I'm sure if you're like me, the first thing that caught your eye about Bitcoin was the price volatility. You wanted to come make money, not really knowing what money is and realizing that Bitcoin is superior money when you look at the properties that compose money. But that number go up is what's going to bring lots of new people into the market. Some of those, they're just going to stay for the number go up. They're going to buy in the ETF and just buy and hold and try to make fiat. But others are actually going to go down the rabbit hole. They're going to learn about Bitcoin. They're going to learn why it's important and they'll start taking self-custody. So you're going to get a new class of hardened, laser-eyed, diamond-handed Bitcoiners from this ETF. I think that's what's not really being spoken of here as much.
Yeah, that's fair. And I, you know, I kind of want to go back to what you said about, you know, I agree with you about the number go up thing. You know, I always kind of say people go into Bitcoin for the money and then they stay for the money, meaning they stay for like the hard money principles, that aspects of things. But I want to go back about to the institutional aspect of things, because I think this is like maybe the biggest like unsaid thing in Bitcoin. And I want to hear your opinion, but I think, you know, everybody loves Michael Saylor and, you know, what he does for Bitcoin obviously is great. I mean, it's like, you know, MicroStrategy essentially being a Bitcoin spot ETF with as much Bitcoin as they have on their own balance sheet. But I'm under the belief that there's no way that a publicly traded company has that much liability and holds, you know, all of their own keys. They have to have some sort of intermediary in there, whether it's, you know, Fidelity or it's, you know, working with something like a BlackRock or holding this a spot ETF, you know, one of them that's approved in another country or something along those lines, instead of, you know, MicroStrategy maybe having, I don't know, 12 seed or 12 word seed phrase or 12 different seed phrases or whatever, and kind of having them dispersed in a multi-sig throughout the company. And so, yeah, like, do you kind of, I guess, subscribe to that theory that, you know, MicroStrategy has some sort of other, you know, intermediary, whether it's Fidelity or whatever, holding their keys, and that, like, you know, a Bitcoin spot ETF can kind of help maybe one, like, more companies get Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and two, kind of, you know, I guess, in a sense, help those institutional guys feel a little bit more comfortable when it comes to, you know, I guess, investing in Bitcoin. I don't really like that terminology, but, you know, I guess purchasing Bitcoin.
Yeah, I agree with the terminology. I like to say save in Bitcoin and then you invest in other things because Bitcoin is savings technology. As far as MicroStrategy, Michael Saylor, he gets it. He's way wealthier than just like a normal Bitcoin pleb, but he understands the ethos. But at the same time, MicroStrategy is a massive company. There's lots of layers there. You can't have one or two guys in control of the entire stash there. So I assume it's a layered custody approach. I'm sure they have some third party, whether it's like Coinbase or Fidelity or like an Unchained that holds some keys. And then MicroStrategy holds some keys. Maybe, you know, Sailor's got one, someone on the board, et cetera. There's so many possibilities about how this custodial sort of debacle can play out in the future. And it's definitely going to be a collaborative custodial approach. I think another thing that's going to, and this is something I've talked to Peter Dunworth a lot about. I don't know if you've had him on the show, but he's the expert on this kind of stuff. It's like time locking. So you can set the Bitcoin where it can't be moved until X block height. And that in itself is a security model, right? Because you can continue to just push the time lock back into the future. And you know that your Bitcoin can't go anywhere. And then the collaborative custody aspect, it's like, let's say I have a key, maybe I have a financial advisor who has a key, and then Unchained or someone like that has a key. We can all, you know, audit the balance at any time, but not one person is able to move it, right? You have to get two of the parties to come in and move it. There's so many different possibilities. And I think in the short term, the spot Bitcoin ETF is like a Band-Aid almost, right? I think in the long run, most institutions are going to want to self-custody, but that's like decades out for sure. But in the short term, you know, the spot ETF is going to continue to drive capital, and, you know, maybe the custodians of Bitcoin could become centralized, right? There could be a few honeypots where a lot of the Bitcoin is held in one or two different custodians. And that could be a vulnerability if you have your Bitcoin with those custodians. So like I say, you always have to self-custody. It's just it's a much different question to tackle if you're an institution, because you obviously can't have one or two people who control your entire stash.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I always think it's like interesting, you know, the way that MicroStrategy has been stacking in El Salvador as well, like as a country, because I mean, I think that there's like inherent risk, right? I mean, with the dollar volatility that kind of, I guess, occurs. And, you know, because at the end of the day, Michael Saylor has come out and said plenty of times that if you hold Bitcoin for 5 or more years, nobody's ever lost money. And so, I mean, you know, obviously that's a kind of a long-term outlook of things, but things change in business, things change in people's lives all the time. So I think that, you know, I mean, we saw it with a bunch of Bitcoin miners who kept a lot of the Bitcoin that was mined on their own balance sheet. And they were unable to ride a lot of those waves through this bear market. And unfortunately, a few of them fell down. So obviously, you know, you look a little bit about, you know, Bitcoin price. You talked a little bit about the mining stocks pumping on this news as well. So like, I guess I'll leave it a little bit more broad for you so you could take it whichever way you want. But, you know, with the, I guess, initial pumps and dumps you know, not only just like Bitcoin price action, but how do you think that affects, you know, not only like Bitcoin companies in general, but mining ones as well?
Yeah, mining really is I work for a mining company, obviously. So it's the thing I'm most excited about. Imagine for a second that Bitcoin does go on this massive bull run that we're all expecting. Spot ETF gets approved, a bunch of institutions rush in, Bitcoin goes to six figures, basically within weeks. Bitcoin hash rate is not going to be able to grow at the same pace because it requires physical infrastructure to get built out, these heavy computers to get shipped from China to the mining sites and plugged in. This is not going to happen overnight. So there's just going to be this window where miners are printing money, like absolutely massive, massive profits. eventually that will get caught up, right? Hash rate, new hash rate will get plugged in. Hash price will sort of rebound. You know, maybe the Bitcoin price will come back down to earth after a little while. But there's this window coming up where Bitcoin miners are going to absolutely be making bank. And that's what I'm most looking forward to. There's so many things to talk about here. So the ASICs themselves have a value too, right? And if you're buying, you know, cheap ASICs now, especially if you're buying these lower generation machines that, you know, let's say Bitcoin doesn't go on a bull run, halving comes, these machines become unprofitable. Everybody's trying to ape into the latest generation machines right now. So the old generation machines are trading at a huge discount. But if you think of it almost like a call option, right? They're basically out of the money now because they won't be profitable after the halving. Everybody's trying to get the new gen machines. But if we go on this massive bull run, suddenly, you know, an S19 96 terahash machine, which wouldn't have been profitable otherwise, is going to be making massive profits. So the price of that machine could actually outperform Bitcoin during the bull run. This is what we saw with S9s during the last bull market. Everybody was trying to upgrade to S19s going into the halving. S9s were super dirt cheap. You could buy a boatload for like very, very cheap. And they actually outperformed Bitcoin. The price of S9s just went on a massive, massive bull run. And it's a trend you're going to continue to see is ASICs having this secondary value on the market. Because in the very early days of Bitcoin mining, each new machine that came out was just so much better than the last one. The previous generation model got made completely obsolete overnight. Its value basically went to zero. But each new machine is better than the last, but only by a sliver, right? So the S19 XP is 21 joules per terahash. They just announced the S21. I think it's 16.5 or 17.5 joules per terahash. Yeah, it's a noticeable difference, especially if margins get really tight around the halving. You want to have as much hash power and the most efficient machines as possible. But it's not so much better that the S19 XP isn't worth anything, right? Especially if we go into these massive bull runs, all the rigs are just going to be worth, they're going to all be printing money, right? So they're going to all have this prolonged market value going into the future. Like, for example, the S21, I expect it'll be around 10 years from now, still mining, right? You're not going to see that with the older gen machines. So there's really an opportunity here. A lot of people, they think when you're mining, all right, you have to completely cover the capital expense of the ASIC, right? With your monthly, daily mining profits, it has to pay for it over a 2 to 3, 4 year time horizon. But that's really not the case anymore because you can sell the machine. You know, let's say you mine for a year, get these massive profits, you sell your ASIC at the top. You had all these mining reward profits in the meantime, and then you're basically recouping the entire CapEx of your machine. So there's so many interesting plays here. The safest play obviously would be to buy the latest generation machines, right? Because you don't necessarily want to bank on ETF approval and a massive bull market as a miner. Let's say Bitcoin's still at 28,000 when the halving comes. If you're not running the latest generation machine and you have a high electricity rate, you're going to be unprofitable. But if you're running latest generation machines and you have a low power rate, all the other miners are going to have to unplug before you. Difficulty drops. You're getting a larger chunk of that block reward. Yeah, it's going to be smaller, 3.125 instead of 6.25, but you're getting a bigger chunk of the pie as your competitors capitulate. That also could create a further opportunity, right? If they're having to not only sell their Bitcoin to try to stay afloat, but maybe they have to liquidate their machines, there's an opportunity there to get cheap hardware. I think the biggest, most interesting play though would be getting like a cheap facility, because like I mentioned at the beginning of this rant, building out these like massive mining sites takes time and effort and energy. But if you can buy a site that's basically already furnished from a capitulator, and then you have a bunch of rigs on the sideline that you can just plug in, that's going to limit that lead time there. So there's, yeah, so many different things we can unpack there if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and, you know, obviously you work for a Bitcoin mining company, and I want to dive more into, like, I guess the aspects of an overall company, but I want to start at home for like home miners, maybe personal miners, that kind of thing, because, you know, it seems like it's kind of like you said, you know, a decent upfront cost with these ASICs. You know, I'm not fully sold that the overall, like, I guess, computing power capability is going to be able to compete with, you know, the ever increasing hash rate and, you know, with the halving periods. So maybe prove me wrong here in a second, but You know, I think that the future of personal mining is, I guess, maybe twofold. You know, maybe personal mining, you have some sort of, I guess, maybe a waterfall or a creek or something like that on your property or pretty damn near close to it. Maybe some excess energy somewhere, solar power. I know in California, if they don't, if you don't use all of your solar power energy, you know, they don't necessarily pay you for it or anything like that. So you could simply plug in a miner and it's energy that you would be obtaining anyway. So, you know, unique ways to kind of utilize excess energy there to mine Bitcoin. Utilizing the heat aspect of things. You know, I'm down here in Florida, so I don't need to necessarily worry about, you know, space heaters or anything like that. But, you know, to my friends up north in Canada and in, you know, the northern United States, they could definitely use that as something for, you know, maybe a space heater or something like that for 4 or 5, maybe even 6 months of the year. And I think, you know, the way that energy prices are going, not only in the United States, but everywhere globally, it'll be very difficult to home mine just because of, you know, the computing power and how much it's going to take. Do you kind of subscribe to that theory that, you know, kind of the home miner is going to have a lot of difficulty going forward? And two, do you think, I guess, there's going to be more creative solutions that you're seeing to, you know, potentially help with that because of those energy costs, like, increasing over time?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Home mining, for better or worse, it's pretty much going to be a thing of the past unless, like you said, one, you have this excess power supply that you can tap into, energy that you're just going to produce anyways. So you can might as well plug a Bitcoin miner into the surplus, or two, if you need to heat your home, right? But just plugging in a machine in your basement and like mining profitably, for most locations, it's not going to work anymore, right? So that's why we've seen the hosted mining basically take off during this halving epoch. And I think there might be some concerns about the decentralization of mining, right? If people can't mine profitably at home, but I think that's completely ungrounded in reality. If you're building out a massive data center to mine Bitcoin, your incentive is going to be to mine Bitcoin honestly. Nobody who would be able to curate the energy and the resources and the ASICs necessary to actually have enough hash power to attack the network, they'd be an absolute fool to do that, because you could mine 51% of blocks honestly in perpetuity and make a boatload of money, or you could double spend one time and attack the network once. You couldn't do any sort of sustained attack. So to basically quell that concern, right, I don't think it's a problem for the network security that home mining is not profitable. But just because it's not profitable doesn't mean you don't want to do it, right? Yeah, if you do live in a really cold remote region, definitely plug in, and there's no reason to run a regular space heater or a regular heating system when you can just run a Bitcoin mining rig and heat your home and still get some sats for doing it. So that's definitely the future of mining as far as like actually making profits. It's going to be institutionalized, and you're going to need large data centers with a very cheap power rate to be able to do that profitably. It's not going to be home mining in your basement and making a ton of money. Unless, I mean, if Bitcoin ripped to $1 million, then yeah, you could probably plug in an S19 in your garage and do all right for yourself.
Yeah, and that's all fair to say. But now let's take a step into the institutional aspects of things, because I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for institutional, you know, Bitcoin mining companies that are simply just, you know, plug and play, because they're, I guess, privy to those, you know, energy costs, right? I mean, they usually sign in a contract for a few years, you know, giving X amount of cents per, you know, kilowatt or whatever it is. And, you know, over time, I think like energy is just going to get more and more expensive, especially if we get farther down this line of, you know, the conflict that we got going on in Europe, not only like Russia, Ukraine, but now the Israeli war going on as well. So, you know, do you think that, I guess, like, does it worry you for, you know, Bitcoin mining, like large companies in general, kind of just based off what we saw, you know, during this bear market? A lot of them had to get purged, unfortunately, sell off a lot of their ASICs that were pretty leveraged in a sense. So maybe, you know, some of them learned from that. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, what do you think of, I guess, the overall health in, you know, Bitcoin mining companies when it comes to, you know, not only the hash rate increasing, but you know, all of these computers and miners kind of, I guess, depreciating in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's where vertical integration becomes a key component here. If you control your own power source, for example, at Blocker, we've partnered with a site in Oklahoma City, and they produce their own energy. I think it's solar and wind. So that's the way, right? If you're producing your own power, you don't have to worry necessarily about what's going on in the rest of the world. If you're mining purely off of like imported natural gas or coal or whatever, then yeah, you're going to be more vulnerable to geopolitical events, you know, OPEC messing with things. For example, CleanSpark, I talked to their CEO on my podcast recently, and they're looking heavily into nuclear energy, right? Because nuclear energy on a, yeah, has a high upfront cost, but on a variable basis, it's not as susceptible as something like oil or natural gas. So on, you know, on a variable, consistent basis, you can be sure that you're going to have that low cost power. And I think this is ultimately the long-term outlook for Bitcoin mining, is that it's just going to become completely integrated with the energy industry. I think 1, 2, 3 decades from now, they're not even going to be separate. Like, it's going to be one and the same, Bitcoin mining and energy, because the fit there is so absolutely perfect and brilliant. There's no other consumer of energy that has the demand for energy all the time in massive quantities, but also has the flexibility to turn off at any moment's notice. And three, can go anywhere and buy the energy no matter where it's produced. Because the other large consumers of energy, you've got like hospitals, maybe a manufacturing plant, and a traditional data center. Well, the problem with all three of those is they can't turn off their power consumption. If there's high demand for power during, let's say, a blizzard or a heat surge, you're not going to want to turn off the hospital's power. That's the last thing you want. If there's only one person or entity in the world that gets power in that scenario, you want it to be the hospital. A manufacturing plant, they can't necessarily just turn off production in like a programmatic way, right? They either have to be going operating 100% or 0%, where with Bitcoin miners, they could, you know, shut off 10, 20, 15, 30, whatever percent of their operations, whatever is needed at the time to give energy back to the grid for other people to consume, Bitcoin miners can turn off to that exact amount. And then a traditional data center like an Amazon Web Service or a Google Cloud, they can't just turn off everything, right? That's their business. But Bitcoin miners, they could turn off no problem, and they can go anywhere because all they need is an internet connection and they're able to mine Bitcoin. So their profile as a consumer of energy makes them perfectly integrated. An analogy I heard that I really like, let's say, Brandon, you owned a cookie store, and I told you, later tonight, I'm going to bring in a bus with 100 teenage boys who are hungry, and we'll buy every cookie you make. So make as many cookies as you want. But if other paying customers come in, we'll leave and they can buy the cookies. But if they don't buy all the cookies, we're here to be that last customer of last resort and buy everything. That's exactly how Bitcoin miners are with energy. So I think net, you're just going to see them merge, whether it's energy companies buying out Bitcoin miners or just having a partnership so they don't have to deal with the operation side and they can focus on what they do best. Or maybe a dream scenario, Bitcoin goes on a massive bull run, millions of dollars, you'll see the Bitcoin mining companies actually buying the energy companies. That's probably the less likely scenario, but so one of those three, we're going to see these two industries just completely integrate over the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Bitcoin mining is going to be something that I'm definitely going to be keeping a close eye on, you know, going forward. But, you know, I guess there's a lot of like, I basically think like Bitcoin can be kind of categorized in like three different areas, right? I mean, we have like, you know, the payment rails options of things, right? The Lightning development, all that kind of things. You know, we get a lot of people talking about the philosophical side of things, like how Bitcoin can change, you know, just the overall world, right? Fix the money, fix the world, all that kind of stuff. And then obviously the mining arm of things. And I think, you know, I guess Bitcoin mining revolution is just kind of being tapped in. So, you know, whether it's, you know, volcano mining in El Salvador, those kind of like innovations have just like kind of been started talked about recently. That there hasn't been a huge development, but it seems like, you know, last year, maybe around this time, there was a lot of resistance when it came to Bitcoin mining. So what is like one thing that really, I guess, maybe worries you, whether it's potential policy coming forward. Maybe it's, you know, Bitcoin mining being too congregated in one state or one area. Like, what is kind of one fear that you have about Bitcoin mining, like going forward, that, you know, could potentially, I guess, shake some things up?
My fear would be that Bitcoin, the price itself, doesn't do what we think it will do. But I think that's highly unlikely. Most people don't understand energy grids, and that's fine. Before I started working in Bitcoin mining, I had no idea. Like, this light I've got, I just turned it off. But when I turned it on, that power, it was redirected somewhere else, right? It's not being stored. It's already being produced, and it's just being redirected to me. There's so many intricacies to the energy industry that even I myself, who have, you know, I've tried to learn as much as I can. There's plenty of things I don't know. But the important thing is that the people who basically matter, the energy producers, they get Bitcoin mining. It doesn't necessarily matter if the rest of the world doesn't understand it. They think Bitcoin miners, they're wasting energy, they're causing everyone else's prices to go up. That's not the case. But the people who think that aren't the people who matter. Even the politicians, to some degree, when you just look at the local level or the state level, the state of Texas, they get it. They can see what Bitcoin miners are doing, the positive impact they're having. Other states can see it. It doesn't really matter what the New York Times or Elizabeth Warren think. Texas, the federal government could pass whatever they want on Bitcoin mining. Texas is going to keep mining Bitcoin. They're going to keep making themselves the home for Bitcoin miners because it benefits their community. It's game theory. People throw that term around a lot, and I think it can get sort of oversaturated and maybe overused, but that's what it is. It's game theory because Texas, it's their best move to accept Bitcoin miners. North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Georgia, North Carolina, Kentucky, it's all in their personal interest as a state to accept Bitcoin miners. So I'm not necessarily either concerned with centralization into these states as well, because states have sovereignty in their own right, and there's different plays in different locations, right? Maybe you want to go to Texas and you want to overproduce with solar and wind and mine that way. Or maybe you don't want to mine in the heat, so maybe you go up north, and maybe you're mining in a remote region in Canada, right? So, or maybe you're mining in a volcano in El Salvador, or maybe you're mining with trash in some South American company, right, or country. You're just burning like waste and mining Bitcoin that way. There's so many different options. The physical geographic centralization is a concern to me. And then, like I mentioned earlier, I don't think there's anything regulatory thing that necessarily scares me, because ultimately the energy producers see the benefit it has and they're going to embrace it as a technology.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the energy producers are just starting to kind of come around. I mean, we've seen Duke Energy, one of the biggest energy providers in the U.S., kind of start to come around. But yeah, you know, you mentioned a little bit about nuclear and kind of other power sources going forward. Do you think that that's going to be, I guess, a big movement going forward, whether it's like, you know, the ESG thing, figuring out how to, I guess, make solar or wind or something like that a little bit more sustainable for Bitcoin mining, or using alternative sources that we haven't even really tapped in yet, like nuclear? Like, what is, I guess, some of the things that you're seeing opposed to just, you know, maybe just like plugging into the grid? Is there any, I guess, developments that got you pretty excited going forward in the mining space?
Yeah, nuclear definitely really excites me, but I don't know if that's, maybe it's a pie in the sky idea, because there are a lot of roadblocks to producing nuclear energy, but it's the perfect source, in my opinion. I think it satisfies all camps, right? You've got, you know, the people on the left side of politics who are radically opposed to oil and gas, for better or worse. That's the nature of it. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of solar and wind. I don't think they're very economical, and obviously they require natural gas and like carbon sources to actually produce the solar and wind infrastructure, but that's another tangent. So nuclear, not having those carbon emissions, it appeals to those people if they understood it. And then it also appeals to people who are in maybe on the right, and they're in favor of, you know, oil and gas and like actually more reliable sources of energy, because nuclear is reliable. So I think nuclear really, it appeals to both sides, or it should appeal to all people. But there's just so many regulatory roadblocks I don't necessarily think we'll have like a nuclear energy renaissance over the next decade, but I would love for that to happen.
Yeah, and I had a nuclear Bitcoiner on the pod, so I talked a little bit about that with him as well. So it was a good conversation. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's, I don't know, maybe if it, baseball terms, it's in the first inning, I feel like, as far as like nuclear power goes. But you know, we obviously have the halving coming up here, in the next, we're recording this mid-October. So in the next, 9 months or something, this is probably terrible.
6 months, actually. It's getting close. It's I think 420, the week of 420 is when it's supposed to happen.
Of course. That's so poetic. It seems like, yeah. 69K all time high. And then the next halving, on 420, but, with this all coming up, right? I mean, we've been kind of going through the bear market. We met at Pacific Bitcoin in a bear market. So with all this going on, I guess, what has you, I guess, most jacked up going into this halving next year? Like, what kind of are you most excited about? Especially like working in the Bitcoin industry, right? I mean, you seem to join like in a bear market. So it's been kind of an interesting time for you, just not only like in Bitcoin, but personally as well. So yeah, going into next year, what kind of has you jacked up? I guess I'll take one from BTC Sessions. Like, why are you bullish here going forward?
Yeah, actually, you're right. I did. I basically worked in this industry during a bear market. I joined at the top, basically. So I'm excited to actually be working during a bull market. What has me bullish? One, the spot ETF, like we hit on at the beginning of this podcast. And two, I am excited for the halving because it's going to be a bullish catalyst. Right now, you've got plebs basically are the only buyers and miners are basically the only sellers. And it could be a bloodbath. You've got over 50% of the hash rate at the moment is S19 or equivalent, 100 terahash machines, 28-ish joules per terahash. That's over 50% of the network. Those machines at 6, 7, and 8 cents per kilowatt hour, all of those are going to be underwater after the halving, assuming the Bitcoin price is where it is today, around 28,000. So we could see a massive difficulty drop. Now, granted, a lot of them would probably continue to mine unprofitably because either they've, one, agreed contractually to consume a certain amount of power, so they have to keep mining, or two, they have Bitcoin in reserves that they can just sell, or cash in reserves that they can sort of use to subsidize unprofitable operations for a limited time. But once those weak miners unplug, and once they've capitulated through all their treasuries, they don't have any more Bitcoin to sell, this thing has to go up. It's a mathematical equation, right? Because the plebs who are constantly dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin, they're going to continue to buy. And then they were like, the black swan is the fact that institutions may dip their massive toe into the market at any time, right? So everything I'm talking about with the halving could just be made completely mute, right? Like Michael Saylor says, all your models will be broken. And that's to the upside. If you imagine institutions just putting 10 basis points worth of assets, that's still like trillions of dollars. And Bitcoin has a market cap of $500 trillion, right? And it's not going to be a linear one-for-one increase, because there's only 2 million-ish Bitcoin on exchanges. And then there's like another 2 million that are like semi-liquid have been moved within the past few months. So there's not a whole lot out there in terms of Bitcoin supply. And if demand could just rip up by trillions of dollars at any moment, this thing's going to take off. But what I'm most bullish about at the end of the day is the fact that there's so much chaos in the world. You've got wars going on. You've got just political tensions on the rise. You've got fiat currencies debasing at an insane rate. Even if you go off CPI, which is totally flawed and bullcrap, and it undershoots the actual monetary debasement, it peaked at 9% a couple in 2022, 2021, right? It's still at 3-4%. If you just do simple math, right, you're losing 3-4% a year over like 15, 20 years. That's half your savings, right? So inflation is bad, and it's going to continue to get worse. In 2 weeks, the US has added on $500 billion to their debt in 2 weeks, right? So the long-term outlook for me is that fiat money has to debase. They have to increase the money supply. They have to have inflation run higher than interest rates. And maybe there's a recession that comes in 2024, and we all know what happens when there's a recession. they print more money, and they print more money in a larger size quantity than the last round of money printing, right? So we're just in this weird time where they're not printing as much money, right? They've elevated interest rates, and they're sort of trying to slow the economy. But especially with an election year, they can't just have everything go into a massive recession. They can't have the real estate market tank. They can't have the stock market tank. So they're going to open the money printers once again. And it's almost, it's like a cliche, a meme or whatever, Jerome Powell standing there printing money, but that's what's going to have to happen. And Bitcoin is a life raft against all that chaos, right? It's the one thing in the world that cannot change. The entire world is going crazier all around us, but there's only 21 million Bitcoin. You can run a node and audit that, and you can hold your own keys, and nobody can take it from you. So Bitcoin being this immutable thing in cyberspace that you can take anywhere in a world that's just constantly changing around it is why I'm bullish.
Yeah, man, and that's all great and everything like that too. I mean, we got a lot coming up, but I'm gonna put you on the spot here real quick because, you know, I've gotten like kind of, I guess, two different theories here. Do you think that price is more driven by the halving period, kind of, you know, obviously Bitcoin miners issuing some of that Bitcoin and other things like that? Or do you think it's more influenced by, you know, the hodlers out there? Because I think, you know, what is it, like 60 or 70% of wallets that have had over one Bitcoin, like it hasn't moved in the past couple years or so. So yeah, what do you think, I guess, is the bigger driver of the fiat price? Because, you know, at the end of the day, that is kind of, I guess, the true signal when it comes to just, you know, plebs or other people outside of, you know, Bitcoin, Twitter, and outside of Bitcoin. Like once that's the kind of, I guess, light bulb moment for a lot of people. So what do you think is the true driver of price?
I think it's the combination of both of those. And the 70% of supply hasn't moved in a year. I love that number. And people may criticize that just because they're maybe not a fan of on-chain metrics. And the point there is that it's not exactly the exact number, right? That's not what matters. It's the trend. So you can look on chain and see during the bottom of every bear market, right before the bull market, you get just this contraction of supply. It becomes increasingly illiquid at record high rates. The exact number doesn't matter. It's the trend, right? And then during the bull market, you see some of that supply slowly start to move again. And it goes back in the market. These people that have been holding for a while, they take some chips off the table, so to speak. But right now we're at that point where the people who have been in Bitcoin the longest, obviously they understand this asset better than those who haven't been in Bitcoin very long. They're not holding, and they're accumulating right now at a record high rate. 70% of the supply has not moved in a year. I think that's very significant. And the halving is sort of, if the illiquid supply is like the kindling and the wood and like the big fire, or like all the wood in the fire pit or whatever, then the halving is just the match that lights that.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think, you know, I think it's more so, I guess, on the hodlers, in my opinion. I think, you know, because of 92% or what is it, 92 or 93% of all Bitcoin has been issued and is in circulation at this point. So I think, you know, to be, to think that 8% of the overall supply is kind of, you know, indicative of the overall price of the entire asset, I think is giving that a lot of credit. And I think, you know, it's more so on the you know, the 70%, as you said, like, you know, hasn't moved in a while, right? I mean, it's just, I guess, simple supply and demand to me. But I think, you know, the halving does play a part in it. I think there's, you know, obviously the business cycles and macro events kind of around it as well. Like if you just simply take Bitcoin at face value and see the 4-year trends, you'd think, okay, it's around it's around the halving period. But if you like take a deeper step back and look at, you know, the overall business cycle, kind of the macro trends, seems like every 4 years, obviously the election cycle as well, that's when, you know, businesses and everything has been kind of like, I guess, in a sense, let loose. And that's when the economies are thriving the most, is in those periods. And when you see the overall macro trend kind of hit, you know, a stalemate or whatever, that's when, you know, Bitcoin price drops as well. Obviously, it's a little bit more dramatic. And I think the run ups and downs might be a little bit less, as we're getting more and more people into Bitcoin, right? I mean, it's just, unless they continually print more dollars, and then that, you know, overall fiat supply keeps increasing dramatically, I think the, you know, the swings are going to be less dramatic. But I want to hear your side of things. Do you think I'm wrong on that? Do you think we're still going to see those days where it's maybe the 15, 20% up and down days? Or do you think, you know, we've kind of maybe hit a, I guess, hit a point in Bitcoin's maturity where the volatility maybe might start to go down a little bit?
I understand both camps, because right as Bitcoin's market cap grows, in new inflows and new outflows are going to make less of a dent on a percentage basis. But if the, because fundamentally the volatility doesn't come from the Bitcoin side, right? It comes from the fiat side. So as fiat becomes more volatile, then you might see that volatility in the Bitcoin price increase. But at the same time, if this ETF gets approved, a lot of these asset managers, they don't really sell, right? They just constantly passively allocate client funds into a basket of stocks and bonds, right? If Bitcoin gets put into that category there, right? Even if it's, you know, 60% bonds, 39% stocks, 1% Bitcoin, they're just going to be passively putting inflows into Bitcoin, right? So I think we could see volatility to the upside and might not see volatility to the downside. Maybe that's really bullish and hopium of me, but to me, that makes sense, right? You don't see this massive, well, it's been volatile in equities and bonds over the last 2 years, just because, like I said, fiat itself is becoming volatile. But if you get, if you're getting consistent passive inflows into Bitcoin, I think that could really do a lot to reduce the downside volatility. So we might see, you know, we could see a massive bull market, and maybe we've seen the end of these 80, 70, 80% drawdowns during the bear market.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I guess time will tell on that, right? And it'll be pretty indicative in the next bull market, right? I mean, we've seen the run-up kind of be delayed compared to a lot of like the timing of the halving period. If you kind of take a step back and look at it, it seems like the run-ups start later and later each time. Maybe it'll be a little bit different this time when we get a recession and some more money printing. But, you know, obviously, you know, it all kind of revolves around the fiat. So, you know, one last question before I let you go here is just based on like the overall debt of the system, right? I mean, we've hit a new all-time high in the U.S. governmental debt. And I always think, you know, people, you know, I guess on one side of things think, you know, tax the rich, tax more people, get more money kind of flowing in. But if you kind of take a step back and look at the overall numbers, that the amount that is taxed, it always comes in. It is hitting, you know, new all-time highs on a year-over-year basis, you know, seemingly every single year. But it seems like we get more and more in debt. And I think it's, you know, not because the government has an inflow problem, but more of an outflow problem, meaning they have a spending issue. So with all these kind of like macro factors going on, right? You know, we have student loan repayments opening up, credit card debt getting at a new all-time high, personal savings getting at a low, right? You know, housing kind of showing some cracks and a bunch of other things, you know, going forward here. So, you know, I guess, what do you see as the way out of it? Obviously, Bitcoin is, you know, theoretically the life raft that many of us see in the long term. But where do you kind of lie on these things as far as like, I guess, Bitcoin adoption goes? Do you think, you know, the current system is going to have to crash and burn? Or do you think like, you know, there might be some sort of intermediary and we're still kind of decades away from a Bitcoin standard? Yeah, where do you kind of land on in that camp?
If I had to choose one outcome, I would say, I mean, fiat could quite literally crash and burn. Our dollar is not immune to hyperinflation. It has happened to other societies. Debt burdens are so high. And you're right, spending is the problem. But the problem within the problem is that they can't reduce spending. They owe some $200 trillion in Social Security and Medicare over the next couple decades, right? They can't rug pull the baby boomers out of their Social Security benefits. No politician is going to advocate for that. So they cannot get spending down. They can't just tax everything you make, right? That's not going to work. So the way out is to debase the currency, and the rate at which the currency gets debased. I mean, if it's, you know, 10, 15, 20% a year, that's not going to be very good. And a lot of people may have to adopt Bitcoin just out of pure necessity. And someone here overhearing me say this might think, oh, you're just saying that because you think it'd be good for Bitcoin. I don't think it'd be good for Bitcoin. Everybody's just jumping into it because they have to. Bitcoin is good as a money, right? But money is good for trade, right? And if we get hyperinflation, God forbid, it's not going to be a whole lot of trading going on, right? It's going to be absolutely chaotic. Businesses are going to collapse. Society is going to deteriorate overnight. So yeah, Bitcoin will be there for you and you'll be able to preserve wealth or whatever, but there's not, your quality of life will probably go down for everyone, right? It's like in 2020, when things shut down and they printed money, assets pumped, but like nobody's working. No, there's no waiter at your restaurant, or there's no DoorDash driver to go pick up your food, or there's nobody working at Walmart to check you out, right? Your quality of life went down, even though your net worth on paper may have went up. There were fewer goods and services going around in the economy. People weren't working. Things weren't getting produced. All these supply chain issues. It's just the fact that like stuff's not being made. So stuff has to be made. People have to be working. There has to be goods being produced, or there's no goods. And even Bitcoin doesn't necessarily fix that right away over time, right? If let's say the dollar hyperinflated, lost all its value, we hit, you know, mayhem in the streets. It's just absolute chaos. Bitcoin will rise from the ashes, right? And the world will choose it because they have no other option left to build a society on top of. So I don't think it's like a great and desirable outcome, but I do think within my lifetime, within your lifetime, we could see the dollar completely go away. I hope that doesn't happen. I hope it's more of a slow transition and the US maybe tries to back the dollar with Bitcoin or something, and they take, you know, they heed the advice of guys like Jason Lowry and Michael Saylor in their ear saying, you know, the US needs Bitcoin because otherwise they're going to lose their dominant position in the world. So ideally that's what happens, but I think the more likely scenario is that they continue to reject it at the federal level. Maybe some of the states will adopt it and they'll be able to do okay for themselves, but I'm not too bullish on like the real world future, right? I'm bullish on Bitcoin, but I think if we get massive inflation, it's going to be very bad.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. Yeah, and I think just, you know, going back to what you said, you know, the fiat dollar system just kind of completely failing isn't good for anybody, right? I mean, like, unless you're completely self-sustained, you're able to get power to your house, you know, you have like a, I don't know, farmland food or something like that stored up for, you know, quite some time. It's just going to be a very, I guess, gruesome time for everybody. And even the biggest Bitcoin bag holders won't be, you know, privy to that, because at the end of the day, you know, as much as people like to think that they're self-sustained, a lot, like majority of people are not able to, you know, be self-sustained. They have to rely on somebody else, some other company, something to provide them electricity, power, all that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I kind of hope that it's, you know, we're at this fiat dollar system, then we kind of have some in-between currency, whether it's, you know, BRICS or the US trying to back the dollar with Bitcoin or other hard assets. And then we get to a Bitcoin standard, because, you know, one, it's a longer transition, which I think would be less, I guess, bloody in a sense. And two, like, I think Bitcoin just isn't really ready for that amount of transaction volumes. Like the Lightning Network, still very young. Bitcoin as an asset is still very young. And, you know, it just kind of like these things take time. There takes a lot of development. And, you know, I guess like even just like running a Lightning node, it sounds like it should be something that is pretty simple. But, you know, from all accounts from everybody that I talked to and discussed with this, it isn't a very easy process. And so, you know, with that liquidity and all that kind of stuff, there is some like issues that persist on the Lightning network that doesn't, I mean, it makes it for a good use case now. But, you know, overall, it is something that, you know, we need a lot more development in the Bitcoin space. But you've been very generous with your time, so I'll give you a little chance here to I guess come back to anything else that I had that I just rambled on about, but also give everybody a shout out as to where they can find you and what all you got going on as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Brandon. I think one last point I'll make is, yeah, I agree Bitcoin's not ready as a global medium of exchange, but I find it really humorous when either altcoiners or no coiners try to use that as some sort of knock against Bitcoin. It's like, oh, it can only, you know, blocks every 10 minutes. The Lightning Network's not fast enough or whatever. Sure, Bitcoin doesn't need to succeed as a medium of exchange for it to be the best store value, right? It still has all the properties you need as a store value. Even if, you know, blocks take 10 minutes. Let's say I can only send one Bitcoin transaction every calendar year because there's just so much demand for block space and blocks are only every 10 minutes. It's still going to be a great store of value, right? So I think ultimately, medium of exchange in like a global Bitcoin circular economy, that's like cherries on top, right? We have this huge sundae. We've got the ice cream and we've got the hot fudge and we got the bananas. That's Bitcoin as a non-sovereign store value that you can put your time and energy into and preserve it over decades, right? Who cares if you can't go to your coffee shop and spend some sats? I just want something that I can buy and hold for my entire life and I don't have to sit here and sweat. I don't have to learn how the stock market works and have to track all these companies and listen to their earnings reports and do all this crap just to save what I make at my job, right? Because you can't do that with fiat. It's going to rot away. So you basically have to become a full-time trader or buy Bitcoin and hold Bitcoin for decades on end. So that's my plan.
Yeah, and that's great, dude. And I appreciate all of that. And yeah, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you? You got a growing Twitter account. You do great work for Blockware. So why don't you give them all a shout out here?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Brandon. You can find me on Twitter at Mitchell Hoddle. So M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L Hoddle. I work for Blockware Solutions. We're a vertically integrated Bitcoin mining company. If you're trying to buy ASICs, hosted or non-hosted, we're the best way to do that. So check us out at blockwaresolutions.com.
Yeah, and that'll be all in the show notes. So be sure to check out his Twitter account and Blockware. And Mitch, man, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thank you, Brandon.